Blog Talk Radio.
Tonight.
There we are, live mic, everybody.
This is Aaron.
Wow.
Very
Hello,
good.
Aaron.
Sorry about that. No intro music. Just you've all got live mic. Tara, do you want me to do intro music?
Only if you know God will cut you down.
Yeah, I got it right here. Just hang in there. Sorry about that. Sorry, everyone, this evening. Please just go ahead and introduce yourself while I find this.
Well, welcome to Walls in Our Minds. And, Aaron, if you're live, which I think you are. Aaron,
keep
are
going.
You hearing me?
Aaron's here.
Well, hello. Let me introduce Aaron Bollinger to everyone. Aaron is the one of the founders of the Sherman Institute. And, Aaron, I'm just going to let you launch right off and give everybody a little bit of background about who you are, where you're coming from, and let them get to know you a little bit.
I've got live music if you want me to do the intro.
No, we're fine.
Okay, very good. Thank you so much, all.
Thank you.
Well, I'm here. Dwayne, you around?
I'm sure he will be.
He called me a few minutes ago just to let me know he was trying to get in and couldn't figure out what was happening, so I explained it to him the way you explained it to me. Yeah, should we go ahead and start or give people a few more minutes to get in here? Or
this is recording, so let's just go ahead and start because people who will listen to the archive won't know the difference.
Okay. Well, I've been in and out of the political circles around the country since about 1981, when we were talking the other day on the phone. I don't know, is Red Beckman with us tonight or not?
He will be.
I'm
shortly.
Here.
Hey,
there I am. I'm here.
Well, I'm in the presence of royalty. I got to say, Mr. Beckman, you're one of the reasons I got active in politics. In fact, I have in my hand here a copy of your Born Again Republic that's got a little stamp that I had made for myself back when I lived in Gaithersburg, Maryland, and it's been since 1984 since I lived there. So I know I've had the book since then. It's got your 1981 copyright date. I'm not sure exactly when I got it or where I got it. But you were one of the first people that I had read, along with Colonel Archibald Roberts' Committee to Restore the Constitution, and I have several other of your books here, The Law That Never Was. I think I either got that one from Liberty Lobby or might have been when I was working with Save a Patriot Fellowship. I have your IRS and the Black-Robed Cover-Up and also The Church Deceived, so I guess, in a way, I've been one of your disciples and just carrying on some of the messages that you and Tupper Saucy and Ed Vieira and all the other good patriot writers from over the past couple of decades have been putting out there, trying to wake people up. And ever since I've been in this movement, there's always somebody in the background that says, man, wouldn't it be nice if the patriot community would start its own college or university and help grind out people that know this stuff and can learn these kind of things in some kind of a controlled environment instead of everybody having to do everything the hard way. And, of course, if you've been in this patriot community longer than about 2 weeks, you understand the flawed logic of that in some ways. That's one of the things that makes it a constitutionist movement. Everybody's a rugged individual, so it's really hard to get folks to work together the way the radical left does, to actually make large groups of people work or play nicely in the sandbox to achieve some greater end. But we've been thinking about it and talking about it, and finally a couple of people contacted me about a year ago and said, let's quit talking about it and do it. So I was called on to kind of bring a little bit of undergraduate programming together, while one of our other founders is kind of focusing on the graduate side of it. He wants to be able to bring PhDs and masters in that want to teach people things like public administration at a much higher level. My first thoughts when I heard about that idea was, you know, the pathetic state of American academia today in the high schools and colleges, you know, how are you going to start teaching such things as comprehensive annual financial reports and material like that when the average student graduating college even has never read the Constitution? They just look at it as a point of departure for Supreme Court decisions. So I started putting this undergraduate program together, and lo and behold, come a month from now, we're ready to roll out the first test semester of programs. We got about a dozen in the hopper. Which ones we actually offer is kind of going to be based on market demand. But one of the courses I built in the textbook to go with it is called State Government 1. It's got an official course number of 153 in the undergraduate collection. But I've worked on Capitol Hill as a registered lobbyist and been involved in all types of political action and campaigns at the state level. Mr. Beckman and a few other people probably remember back in the mid-80s when Jim Davidson and the National Taxpayers Union was running around trying to open a constitutional convention under the premise of a balanced budget amendment. Me and Trish Capson for Liberty Lobby were running around Vermont and Kentucky and Louisiana and all these other states working at the committee level to defeat those bills and keep the first convention since 1787 from happening. And just, you know, the knowledge that we've all gained over the years in those state battles has gone into this course. You know, a lot of people have heard of the Jefferson's Manual and they understand certain things like parliamentary procedure, but that's where it's really all at. If you want to get a bill out of committee, you got to know the rules of the chessboard you're playing on. So, you know, there's some states that don't even use Jefferson's Manual. They use one called the Mason's Manual. And, of course, the first time I say that to most people, they think I'm talking about the Order of Freemasons. And no, there was a guy named Paul Mason who wrote a manual of legislative procedure. He assigned the copyright to the National Conference of State Legislatures. And the vast majority of our states now use the Mason's Manual, the Paul Mason's Manual. And that's one of the textbooks that I'll be teaching from in this State Government 1 course. We've got a professor from down in Georgia who's going to be teaching two courses. He's developed one called History of Protestant Denominations, where he looks at the backgrounds and origins of all of what we now know of as theology in this country and how it came to be. And we've got some other people that are either coming on board or in the process of developing courses and getting things ready for our actual grand opening, which will take place in March. But we're going to do a test semester, start, you know, experimenting with various pieces of technology to roll out these distance learning courses. So it's not a brick-and-mortar facility. You know, you can be sitting in Barrow, Alaska, if you want to, and as long as you got either a telephone and email, you'll be able to take these courses and study with some pretty savvy minds. And that's what we're all about. We've quit talking about it and started building something here that hopefully can be part of the solution. So, you know, with that general introduction, I'm certainly here to answer people's questions. And yes, we are looking for instructors. So if there's folks on here that have some college background or a teaching certificate and would like to experiment with something or find out more about what we're doing from the instructor side. You know, we're here to find students. We're here to find instructors. We're starting to get the word out now. The planning is pretty much behind us. The rest is implementation. So I'll open it up to anybody that's got any questions or comments or just want to take it off in a different direction to discuss some of these things.
Well, there's a lot of things to talk about. Perhaps you could give us just a little bit more feel for, you know, some of your legislative lobbying work, particularly like Restore the Republic, what your experience with Aaron Rousseau was, that sort of thing.
No, I've had a lot of fun with all these folks. Let's see. How about a good story? When we were fighting the ConCon, I was actually working for Liberty Lobby at the time. We went to Vermont. That was one of the places where they had one of these convention calling bills sitting in a particular House committee, and we knew where it was going to be heard about 10 days in advance. So we had to develop a plan pretty quickly, and we did. A couple of us created a particular flyer, but we customized it so that we could distribute it in the particular districts, and it would have the phone number on of the particular committee chairman or members of this committee that were going to be hearing it. We printed about 5,000 flyers for the district of the chairman and a couple of thousand for each of the members. And then we did a general circulation one for the entire state just so that, you know, we could cover it. Vermont's a pretty small piece of real estate. It's mountainous, so you got to know your way around up there. But between the printers and the locals and the folks that we knew within our network, we managed to get 40,000 pieces of literature printed. Now, if you know anything about political science, you understand the logic behind passing out literature. You can expect a return, if it's a really well-done piece, of anywhere from 2 to 5%. So, you know, if you got 100 flyers out there, you'll get somewhere between 2 and 5 phone calls, people that will actually follow the instructions of the flyer and do something. Well, in this case, we're talking about protecting the Constitution. So that's a little higher-edge piece than, you know, your average Obamacare or something else piece of literature that, you know, ho-hum, so what. People took it a little more seriously, and of course Vermont's pretty solid Second Amendment state. We made sure there was a couple of things in there about what their plans were to rewrite the Constitution and take away the Second Amendment and things of that nature. So it attracted a fairly good return. I would say we probably got more like an 8 to 10% call ratio. You can imagine the effect of putting out 40,000 pieces of literature from the top to the bottom of that state in 3 days, the number of phone calls that started coming in. And when we hit that state, we went up there to, you know, we started distributing on Monday, knowing the committee meeting was on Friday. Within 4 days, by Thursday, we were done. We went to the state capitol. And I remember it distinctly because we wanted to visit with the committee chairman. We walked in there, and the secretary, you know, we introduced ourselves and said we'd come up to talk about this bill. And the committee chairman happened to be behind the door. I don't think his feet touched the floor when he came out of his chair over the desk wanting to talk to us. Can you please make these phones stop ringing? I'll take you in. You can watch us kill that bill. It's not moving out from underneath my desk. We're going to kill it. Please make these phones stop ringing. That just goes to show what, you know, there was no more than probably a dozen of us working on this thing. But these guys were so enthused about getting this bill out from underneath their attention and getting these phones to stop ringing that they would have just about done anything to make it happen. But, you know, that's what it takes. It takes people that understand, you know, how to do this stuff in order to win some of these battles that we're fighting. Aaron Rousseau and Ilona Blakely kind of brought me back into the movement. I had gotten into more ministry-related stuff and was living in South Carolina as part of Christian Exodus when this whole Real ID battle came up. And Alona found out that I had, you know, state experience, and they were going to try to fight Real ID in Columbia. So they brought me into the battle there. And by the time I and a few others got involved, the bill to defeat Real ID had already made it through the Senate and into the House, but it was really weak. You know, it had that language in there that said, well, we don't want to do this unless the federal government pays for it and unless this and unless that. And I told Senator Martin, the chairman or the sponsor of the bill, you know, that's all well and good, but you know how Washington operates. If you give them an excuse, they'll provide you the money. You know, we don't want Real ID whether they pay for it or not. Would you support stronger language in the bill if I can get the House committee to amend it? He said, well, I don't know that we got enough support, you know, in the legislature to win the favor of a bill that's any more strongly worded than this one is. I said, well, my question was, if I can get you the support, will you support the stronger language? He said, sure, if you can get the rest of the legislature to go along with it. So, you know, about 30 of us were really working hard. We were going back and forth and coursing the halls of the South Carolina Assembly and passing our literature out and talking to people face-to-face. And, oh, man, there was a couple of people we didn't even expect to be on our side that came out as champions for us in the House committee and introduced the amending language. And what I did in that case, it was really fun because we seen, you know, how the senator had laid it out and put those unless Washington does this and unless Washington does that. So we thought we'd make it interesting. We'd add about 10 more unless Washington, so we just made it so difficult that there's no way they could have ever complied with all the restrictions we were going to put on it. And then I told the guy that was going to introduce the amendments, I said, or instead of adding each of those 10 amendments to it, here's one we'll put at the bottom. It just says, put a period right after the sentence that says South Carolina shall not participate in the Real ID Act. Put the period right there, strike everything else out, and that'll accomplish the same thing. So which would a legislator want to do? Introduce 10 amendments or make it simple? You know, coming close to the end of the session, they wanted to make it simple. So we got what we wanted by appealing to their natural tendency to try to make life as easy as possible. And it worked. The vote was 49-0 in the Senate and 109-0 in the House. We got unanimous consent for the strongest language of any of the no Real ID bills that had been passed up to that point and maybe since. But, you know, you have to know the rules. You have to know where to get the bills tweaked, how to work the committees, you know, how to find your champion, the rules of the game. And that's what we'll be teaching in the state government course.
Well, I have a quick story to try to tell you. And I think it's worth us talking a little bit more about what it takes to get something done in a state at this point. Earlier this year, I get a phone call here in Colorado. And the phone call said, did you know that they just put through a voice vote for a call for a con for a balanced budget amendment? And I said, I had no idea. And I'm a precinct captain here. I'm also vice chair of my House district. So, you know, you would expect that I would have heard something about this. Well, there was absolutely no warning whatsoever. And my own representative actually spoke on behalf of this thing. And I'm not going to name names. I'm not going to embarrass anybody here. But make a long story short, I jumped in the middle of it really quick and found out that they did not have a clue what they had stepped in. Not a one of them. Now, maybe the Speaker of the House had a clue, but what annoyed me the most was that they did it on a voice vote.
Well, and that's two reasons. Number one, leadership knows the rules. And if they let that get around too much and do much talking about it, people will catch on. Because as our committee chairman up in Vermont said, no one's going to want to touch that bill for the next 20 years, the way the public reacted when they found out what it was and that it was there. So that's the way they've been behaving nationwide. They're trying to sneak these things through. Unfortunately, we've got people like you out there kind of keeping an eye on this stuff. And we have been able to nip it in the bud in the few states where it has popped back up.
Make a long story short. I immediately got my House representative on the phone, and I started asking him questions. I started asking him, but what is this that you've done? He said, well, it really wasn't an official call for a con. It's just really a superficial thing, where we're making it clear that we want a balanced budget amendment. And I said, well, did you call for a con or did you not? He says, well, according to the attorneys, they made it sound like this was really just a superficial thing, more of a political statement than anything official.
Right.
So he immediately says, let me have him call you. So he has one of the attorneys from that consult with the legislature. He had this guy call me on the phone. So I get him on the phone, and I start asking him. I said, do you have any idea how many states have already called for a con? Well, no. Well, can you tell me, you put language in here that says if it's not specific to a balanced budget, that you're rescinding it. Can you explain the law to me or cite the law to me that allows you to do that? Well, no. And I said, well, do you recognize that a con, once it's called, there's no way to limit the scope of that con, that the attendants to that can take that anywhere they want, just the way they did in the one constitutional convention that we've already had? Are you aware of that, if there's no way to limit that? Well, no, we think that, you know, the language we put in there could do that. And I said, oh, really? Well, what happened in the first Constitutional Convention? They just came together to make some amendments to the Articles of Federation.
Yeah, and when New York walked out, did that keep the convention from happening?
These legislators are putting in their votes based on what legal counsel did. Now, I don't remember the legal counsel being elected for office.
I don't remember the legal counsel there having enough knowledge to even render an opinion.
He didn't. I told the guy more than he knew. I mean, I knew more than the legal counsel that advised them on this knew.
Well, just for everybody's benefit, if you're unfamiliar with that whole con subject, up on our veterans website, nvcca.net, if you go to the documents page, there's a collection of materials there about the convention. And frankly, one of them was written when I was with Liberty Lobby. They've been around for a long time. They explain those minutia to people that are unfamiliar with it. And if you need something to grab and hand to a state legislator that explains this stuff to them in question and answer format, that's a good document to have a hold of. Just go to nvcca.net and look for the documents page and something that says Constitutional Convention or Con, and those are the materials you want. And that doesn't address the whole balanced budget situation either. We've ripped apart every model amendment that they've put forward since the beginning of time, and none of them would actually achieve an annually balanced federal budget. We all know it's mathematically impossible to balance the federal budget so long as every dollar is being borrowed into circulation from the Federal Reserve. But they don't see that. They don't understand that. They haven't studied the Constitution or history enough to even have a clue about those things. Which brings us to another topic. One of the courses that we plan to offer, well, in fact, several, on economics. If anybody's ever read Edwin Vieira's book Pieces of Eight, that's the textbook for our courses on economics.
Aaron, do you know if he's got that online yet? Because I know he was trying to digitize it.
Well, he's talked about it, but I've talked to Mr. Vieira about this many times, and he went to the expense even of having a law book publisher publish it. And I don't really think there's any way that he can, in confidence, secure, you know, a PDF version of that. Once it's out there, it's out there, and he'll probably never sell another book. It's just the realities of this industry. The National Conference of State Legislatures is taking the same approach. They're, you know, even though the Mason's Manual is something that should be considered public information, that you should be able to get just as easily as you can get, well, we won't even say that, because in some cases it's not so easy to even get a copy of your state constitution anymore. But you should be able to get a copy of the rule book so you understand what's going on when you're sitting up there in the gallery and you hear, you know, a point of order or a motion for this or to table that, you know, what's happening there, what was going on. But no, even the National Conference of State Legislatures isn't making a PDF version of the Mason's Manual available for students or academia or anything. If you want it, it's $75. And I think with Mr. Vieira's book, it's a, you know, two-volume set now. And I think it's $150 for the two books. But,
well, I'd like to find out where you
can
get it for that. I have not found it for online for $150. I've seen it for about $350.
You ain't going to find it probably online. But, you know, if you have a contact with Mr. Vieira or if you need a contact with Mr. Vieira, email me and I'll put you in touch with him. Just buy it direct from him.
Well, I have direct contact with him, and I've asked him for that, and he didn't have it available at the last time I talked to him. So,
well, it's been in print and some issues there with it, but I was down not too long ago, met with him in person, actually filmed him on video for a couple of things that we were doing. We did an economic summit in South Carolina this spring. And believe it or not, we had 10%, a full 10%, which is 18 out of 170, so slightly over 10%, of the legislature attend an economic summit. We had Ed Vieira and Jeff Turk and Larry Parks.
James Turk.
No, we had Jeff.
The guy with goldmoney.com?
Yeah, there's two brothers involved, Jeff and James, or father and son. I forget which is which, but Jeff was the one that was on with us. And we did it. We did it by Skype video conference. Now, we did two things. First of all, the Sound Money Committee, you know, our allies in South Carolina, rented a meeting banquet hall right down, right off of Senate Street in the state capitol, a place where frequently, you know, lobbyists and everybody else rents the place and feeds the legislators. So, you know, we did that and brought him in and had the conference and was teaching them about gold and silver coin. And there's two bills introduced now, a House version and a Senate version. The senator that's the chairman of the Senate Banking Committee introduced the Senate version, and Mike Pitts introduced the House version. But that's an accomplishment, to get 10% of any state legislature to attend a conference on gold and silver coin. No small achievement. But, you know, it's like anything else. It takes organization, planning, you know, the funding to pull something like that off and, you know, provide meals for everybody and all the things that went into it, the technology. And they even had to wire the place because they weren't the one meeting room that we rented, the banquet hall, didn't have the right high-speed internet connection in there to even make a good presentation. So we had to even put that in ahead of time. And then the senator gave us a Senate meeting room for the next day. So between the 2 days, you know, we had legislators that couldn't make it to the first one that came to the second one and vice versa. But we did, you know, back-to-back 2 days of this economic summit on how to get gold and silver back into the hands of the state. So I've been involved in all kinds of this stuff over the years.
what about grassroots support, Aaron? I know that the reason the states that had introduced Vieira's legislation, the bill that he wrote. The reason that they had died in committee along party lines was primarily believed to be a lack of grassroots support.
Well, that's always going to be a problem. You know, even if you and I and Tupper Saucy understand the concept of trading amongst ourselves in gold and silver, it's a whole nother level of interesting when you talk about doing that at the state level. And, you know, there's, it's kind of like, remember the old saying, when the people lead, the leaders follow? This is what has to happen. We've really got to, you know, and we spent a lot of time working on this at the summit, and it was very nice in that a lot of mom-and-pop businesses, furniture stores, you know, people like that came because they seemed to be thinking along the lines of, okay, yeah, I could mark my furniture, you know, this many FRNs and this many silver pieces. So once the public understands that and begins doing it, it will only be natural for the legislature to say, our public is grabbing gold and silver. It's idiotic that we're not. And this is part of the education process. When you get enough of the public doing these things and demanding it, then it almost becomes a no-brainer for the state to follow suit. And even if they only do it at an incremental level, and that's what most of the Vieira, and of course, Dr. Vieira has authored a half dozen different bills, pretty much tailored for what it is that that legislator who's interested thinks will work for his state. I think it was the one they did for New Hampshire. It just said that they would start collecting the cigarette, the tobacco tax, in silver, and then they would apply that to a fund and start putting it out, you know, to the public through various things, like maybe backing up part of their retirement funds for teachers or this, that, or the other. And then when that money disappears, when that gold and silver is gone, if they need more and there's more demand for it, then they can look at maybe another type of a tax that they could begin collecting it in and replacing paper with gold and silver when it starts being demanded. But, yeah, there's all kind of political stuff. I mean, you don't think the banks are going to take it lying down, and there's as many reasons that this bill has or that these types of bills have problems as there are bankers to cause problems. But, you know, we're working in those directions. And one of the things that we did through the Veterans Group, we published a book called American Leadership Magazine. And over the years, you know, the Vieira legislation, stuff that I did as a hired gun for the Gun Owners of America a few years back, and stuff I seen even from Colonel Roberts and pretty much anybody that's put together a good piece of model legislation for whatever purpose it may have been intended is all collected now in one place. So this is a perfect opportunity if we start teaching this type of material. You know, you could put together a course on reforming American government, and here you've got, you know, 50, 75 pieces of model legislation and the issue briefs that go along with them. And let's take a look at, well, how do we fix this problem? How do we fix this problem? And what do we need to do to achieve it? So those are some of the kinds of things that I think Sherman Institute can be a groundbreaking academic institution to do. And to have people like Larry Parks and Ed Vieira, I mean, you know, you're not going to challenge the credentials of a guy who's got 4 degrees from Harvard or a PhD like Larry Parks. You know, these folks are vetted, good quality instructors. We've found another person just yesterday. I spent a while on the phone. Have a doctor's in rhetoric and communication. You know, that's a doctor's in English. So, you know, to have those kind of people working with us as instructors or deans, Yeah, it's going to be a little bit difficult for academia to look at us and say, well, this is just a ragtag bunch of idiots, so you shouldn't attend their courses. You know, we've got some good quality people connected with this, and you know, it's moving forward nicely.
I'll tell you what, to have the opportunity to be taught by Larry Parks is sufficient reason for even an old coot like me to take a course, because you don't get a higher quality person than that to be able to even dialogue with, much less have him actually teach you according to something that he's laid out.
You're right, you know, and even Ed Vieira, you know, a lot of folks find the reading in the textbooks, you know, in something like Pieces of Eight, you know, that's just so heady, dry reading. But if you watch the video that I put together with Dr. Vieira, he's sitting there with flashcards. Okay, you know, this says one cow. Now this says, by order of the Department of Agriculture, one cow. Does that make this piece of paper one cow just because the federal government says so? Of course not. You know, so, I mean, he's got the ability to explain economics in a way that a first grader can get it. You know, the reading, the writing level, just way off the charts. But to sit and listen and be taught by this caliber of person, I want state legislators taking these courses. You know, that's one of the things when we were talking to a guy down in South Carolina some time back. It was not the current Speaker of the House, but I think the one that was the Speaker of the House in South Carolina immediately preceding Bobby Harrell, who's there now. How he got to be Speaker, he would take the rule book and read it. Back then it was cassettes. Okay, he sit there and read the manual into a cassette and put it in the tape deck. And even as a freshman legislator, he was studying the rules. And he knew the rules. And if there was ever a procedural problem, he'd catch it. And, you know, he could tell his colleagues, wait a minute, they can't pull that stunt. Here's the rule that actually applies. So we need people in our movement that are that skilled with legislative procedure, because it's become to the point where the concepts of a Thomas Jefferson, if you look in the Jefferson's manual, you'll see one of the rules in there says, if a person has declared his opposition to a pending piece of legislation, he may not offer an amendment to it. Because he is opposed to it, his intention is to kill it. Now, how many times do we see people that we know are against our bills offering an amendment on the floor, but no one from our side calls them on that rule violation? That's a simple thing, and the only reason we don't use it is because our people don't know it. It's a simple rule. All we've got to do is know the rule book, and we can catch them when they do this stuff to us. And that's the kind of stuff I want to be teaching, because I've, you know, been through it with committee hearings and all this other stuff. But that's just a small piece of what we really need to know to be effective activists in our Tea Party groups or whatever the case may be.
Well, we do have Dwayne Moore that is live. We've also got Kurt McKenzie that's live. And Red, you're being awful quiet, so I'm going to give whoever wants to jump in here now and has some interaction with Aaron, please do so. Well, that was dead air. Don't everybody jump at once. Red, are you still there? Do we still have you?
I'm still here.
If I haven't lost Red, I must be doing something right.
I'm trying to digest all this, and of course, I speak out so strong against the education system that we have, and how most education is working, and from my own personal experience. I've watched this, and if you've got a high school graduate, you've got a 4-year college graduate, and then you've got somebody that's got a master's or whatever because they took an extra couple of years. The guy that's got the most education is the hardest one to work with. The others are still learning, and they know it. You get somebody that's gone to the top in the education thing, and they really think they're on top. And so, you know, they've got all the answers. And, boy, that's hard. They're hard to work with.
Well, it's a personality thing. It's like any other circumstances. You know, there are personalities involved. There are some big egos occasionally. So far, you know, from the people that I've talked to, I've just found, you know, the level of enthusiasm to be right off the charts. A lot of them have thought, wouldn't it be nice if something like this comes along? And now that it's actually coming together, you know, they're feeling pretty good about the prospects. And there's the double-edged sword to it. You know, we can have the greatest students and the greatest programs in the world, and if we can't market it and find students, you're not going to attract the better quality instructors. And, of course, you know, you can have a whole bunch of students lined up, and if you can't find the instructors, then you got problems. So, you know, there's a couple of things that kind of all have to come together here at once to make this work really well. So far, the level of enthusiasm among instructors seems to be pretty good. So now our challenge is getting the students. And yeah, it doesn't matter to us if they're, you know, 14 years old and in eighth grade and wanting to start into their program. The way we've laid this out on paper, we would offer an associate's and a bachelor's, at least on the undergraduate side, in any of three disciplines. We've got about 75 courses at least laid out on paper, some of them further along in development than others. But, you know, there would be the opportunity to have general studies, political science, and theology in either associate or bachelor's level programs. So, you know, a kid right out of a homeschool child, you know, 15 years old, parents can't quite keep up with him because he's accelerating past them, we're going to have a program they can drop into. It's got great potential if we can just, you know, keep all the wheels turning. We had a website built. That's one of the big problems just this week. We've been working overtime weeks on this website. It gets hacked. Now, obviously, you know, when you think like someone in the military or with a military background, you realize when you're a bombardier, you know, and you're heading into Germany for a bombing run, the closer you get to your target, the more likely you are to start taking flak. Well, I think we're getting close to target because somebody doesn't like it. And our site is just completely crashed, so we got to start over and rebuild it. But that hasn't affected our courses because we built everything that can be deployed with or without the website. The website was primarily, at least in these initial stages, just to help us with marketing and promotions. So even if there's no website, we can still deploy and get these courses started as of the first week of December.
Well, Dr. Tate, our host here, who you heard her voice at the beginning of the show,
mm-hmm.
has asked a question about how about a Constitution summer school?
No problem there. We've been talking to a lot of other folks that have already developed courses on the Constitution. People like Michael Bednarik may be on board with us before long. And
spoke to Michael today and had a conversation about that in particular.
Yeah, well, we've invited him. We've extended the invitation. And that's part of what our founders envisioned. People who are already, you know, skilled but need a way to deploy a program should be able to just walk right in here and we'll make available to them the ability to deploy it. Even if it's not something that would be part of our you know, associate or bachelor program. It might just be a four-hour continuing ed course that they've developed on, I don't know, bookbinding, whatever. But they need a way to get the information out there to teach the trade or teach the skill, whatever it is. Then, you know, we can help enable them to do their thing inside or outside of our program. So, you know, we're open to all kinds of ideas. Whatever people have that they, you know, just need a way to deploy it. Not everybody's going to take the time to build an elaborate website and do all the marketing. If we can do those pieces, that'll help other instructors, reach their audience.
Well, I'm excited about your program, and I'm certainly going to send a lot of people there, and I know that a lot of our listeners will too. As a matter of fact, we got one guy that says he's got three monster kids and is shipping them all to you.
Well, you know, we would love to have that. That's the heart of this. You know, I'm getting up in years, and as I sit around and I think about what can I do, I can keep running to state houses and teaching people on the fly when a bill's in motion or trying to get in motion and trying to teach 20 people on state house steps how to do this stuff. Or I can apply what I've learned over the years and get 50 activists trained so if I drop dead tomorrow, people can take what I've learned and apply it and keep the thing going. And if we can train a new generation, I think they can pick up where we leave off and leave us in the dust. And that's my hope and prayer that something like this good can come out of it, that we can help, you know, apply our experience to teach the next generation. It's great if continuing ed, you know, adult ed students want to come back and finish their degree, you know, whatever, that's great. But if we can get these 17 and 18-year-olds that, you know, maybe watched Aaron Russo's movie and now they're questioning the meaning of life the way I questioned the meaning of life when I read Born Again Republic for the first time. I was in college then studying criminal justice and I was thinking, this is interesting. This is not what I hear my professor telling me. So.
Well, Aaron, I want to introduce you to Kurt McKenzie. Kurt's been listening very patiently, and I want you guys to interact a little bit because, as I mentioned to you before, Kurt has a plan. And I appreciate Kirk a lot because partly what he's doing with the sheriffs, but mostly because he's really spent some time researching what's going on with our country. And I believe that his plan that he's put out there is really a team approach. And I believe that when this is all said and done, that we're all going to be working together towards doing a lot of things that are going to make a difference in this country. And the educational process is a key element of that. And, Kurt, say hello to Aaron, please.
Well, Aaron, it's been great to hear you. I'm glad to meet you online here.
Well, thank you, sir, and glad to know of you, too. I've worked with Larry Pratt and studied some of these books on sheriffs and did research on Blackstone and put together material like that for a number of years from the legislative side. If you've looked at these sheriff things, you understand only too well that in a lot of jurisdictions there have been laws passed that basically cut the legs out from underneath the sheriff. They delegate him back to the role of maybe courthouse security or running the jail, but they lose their other functions to some county hack, county sheriff's or county police department. And some of what I've done is actually in the bill drafting realm to undo some of the damage that Code Home Rule and 1313 and Public Administration Clearinghouse and all those folks have been doing. Advisory Commission on Intergovernmental Relations. I mean, they've got these state houses these days have all these well-funded think tanks throwing bills at them saying sign here, sign here. It's to the point where if you go into a state capitol and say we need a bill written on this, it's way too abstract for them. They can't figure out how to do it anymore because they're so accustomed to having prepackaged model legislation handed to them that they can just drop in the hopper, that's one of the things we've been trying to do through the veterans group. You know, draft the legislation for them. Don't give them any room to get it wrong. Write it for them. Hand it to them. Introduce this. Oh, okay, looks good. Yeah, I think my constituents would like that. So
let me give you a little background on what I've been doing, Aaron, just so we can kind of get calibrated here. I'm in agreement that the monetary system has to be reformed, and it's a core problem of what we've got. I've written a book called Money Defending Your Prosperity, which is kind of a primer meant for people who don't know anything about it to be able to walk into the topic and have their minds changed, and I think that we continually have to do that. And that's turned into a series of seminars, which turned into a series of YouTube videos. And then I participate in grassroots organizations of various types and in giving presentations. I was the California State Chair for Ross Perot's United We Stand America. And since that time, I've been studying the world for a long time. And I've come to the conclusion that all roads lead to New York City and the monetary banking system and the international bankers. I frankly don't care whether you're going to go after education, you're going to go after sovereignty, you're going to go after, you know, the debt, you know, whatever issue, the attack on our culture, it emanates from there. And so the book was a endeavor to try and begin to broaden the audience to understand the Fed. It's not a conspiracy-oriented book. It's just a primer. People within a first chapter begin to understand it, and then in a gut level. In my interaction with grassroots organizations, and comparing that to what I had done before, I came to the conclusion that I feel that they're not really doing what they need to be doing. And so I wrote or generated a YouTube video called How to Take Our Country Back, which is at the moment has 33,000 views, hopefully a lot of those key activists that you're talking about. And that laid out a strategy, I think, what we need to have, and it talks about defensive and offensive strategies, and it talks about using history as a guide to understanding what really is important to do. And then that was followed up with How to Take Our Country Back Part 2, which talks about, okay, now I know where I'm headed, I know what the map is, and now I need to know how to get there. So that's the tactical aspects of it.
Mm-hmm.
And then more recently, I have been involved with trying to figure out how to help defend rural America against this government onslaughts through the Endangered Species Act, through the taking of water, property rights, monuments, you know, so forth, closing off the forests. And I was one of the principal organizers of the event on October 22nd, where we actually had a panel of eight sheriffs, including Sheriff John Lopey and Glenn Palmer from Oregon, who came together and stood tall, basically said they're going to defend the Constitution. So we actually have a situation where all of the elements that we normally talk about, with perhaps the exception of the monetary system, are actually there. And they're fighting back to save this, and it brings in legal aspects, social aspects, constitutional aspects, communication, how do you organize. I mean, everything you need to know, it's there in the microcosm. And so I've been involved in that. So I could expand on that or strategies, or somewhere in the course of this dialogue, I would also like to know more about kind of a thumbnail sketch of really what is the objective of the state monetary reforms. What are the key things that you feel the legislation has to do, and how does it solve a problem? Because I don't particularly understand the details of Dr. Vieira's program. I'd certainly like to understand more and compare them to my own ideas and try and understand how that's going to work. I like the idea of trying to do something at the state level, but I'm not sure I quite comprehend exactly what it's going to accomplish, so I'm curious to know that. So wherever you want to take that conversation.
Well, yeah, and I can give you the two-minute version of it, because they're all very, very simple strategies, and they all achieve a very specific purpose. Now, the language of the various bills may be different, but here's the thing. What do they do when they want to withdraw a heroin addict from heroin? They put them on methadone, right? Got the idea? You can't eliminate the Fed. You can't destroy or, you know, outlaw Federal Reserve money unless there's something to replace it with. We've got to have a money system in this country. So the concept behind the Vieira bills is a very simple one. There is gold and silver out there. It, you know, it's not readily available, but that's because there's no market at the moment, or a very, very small microcosm of society is actually demanding it. So what you're trying to do at the state level is gradually wean people off of the Federal Reserve notes by collecting, you know, like the New Hampshire bill suggested, the collection of the tobacco tax. And even then, at the point of sale, it's not going to be collected in gold and silver. But what will happen is if, you know, the merchant is required to submit their, you know, tax forms, whatever it is, they convert it before they send it to the state. Or can be written the other way. When that money comes in, the state will become the purchaser and buy the gold and silver with that amount and only that amount of money. So, okay, now let's see if there's a demand. Does the teachers union want gold and silver instead of paper in their, you know, retirement accounts? Well, they'd have to be idiotic not to. If they were given the choice, what would most people prefer to have? Gold and silver, which is continually appreciating against a depreciating paper form of money, or would they prefer to keep the paper? Well, wait a minute. We're teachers, okay? So, you know, we as state teachers get that. Now suddenly the police department turns around and says, wait a minute, you're giving that to the teachers. How about us? How about the firemen? So little by little, incrementally, as people catch wind of what's happening, the demand will be greater on the state for more and more gold and silver. And, you know, it's a real simple thing, a law of physics, almost. It's a law of economics, but it's just as valid as any other law of nature or nature's creator, that good money dries out bad. If you start having some form of parallel...
Actually, I think it's the other way around. Bad money dries out good because people hoard the good money.
Well, but see, there's where the demand is. People will hoard it, but they want it. It's desirable. Therefore, it is driving the bad out. People are converting it. They're taking that gold and silver. And then if other people start wanting it, you know, now your merchants come along and say, yeah, you know, you can buy this sofa. It's 250 Federal Reserve notes or 6 ounces of silver or whatever, you know.
Would you denominate these silver coins in weight or by dollars?
Well, here's how I'm doing it for Sherman Institute. We would be absolutely hypocrites if we insisted on being paid in Federal Reserve notes while we're teaching economic principles of gold and silver. So I've set up my courses so that when someone pays for a course, they got two options. They can either do some serious math, or my course costs 7 ounces of silver, which equates to 9 faced dollar value of U.S. silver coins. So if you want to send me the silver rounds, it would be 7 of them. It would be $9 in any combination of dimes, quarters, halves, and Morgans or peace dollars or whatever. Or you look at the close of business yesterday, multiply that times 7, you know, the silver spot price to close a business the day before you register for the program. And if it's 35 an ounce, then you do 35 times 7. Or if it's, you know, $60 an ounce, you do 60 times 7. So the cost of my course, if you're going to pay me in Federal Reserve notes, is going to be based on how badly this stupid paper has depreciated against the real dollar. Simple concept. It forces people to think. A lot of folks don't like to do that. But, hey, if we're going to teach economics, shouldn't academia be one of the places where, you know, the solutions start emanating from? Just a common, to me, it just, you know, it makes too much sense to ignore.
Let me jump in with a question then, Aaron. So you would basically have the state issue coins denominated in ounces or basically by weight. Is that correct?
Did you say state-issued coins?
Yeah. Isn't that
No. No, the Constitution prohibits any state from coining money, so they're going to have to use what's available. It would either be, you know, United States pre-1964 coinage, or they could, you know, take Canadian maple leafs or Krugerrands or, you know, bungee-jumping kangaroos from Australia. It doesn't really matter as long as the weight and fineness meet the standard. You know, no state may coin money. That's a constitutional prohibition. And that's one of the things that the media loves to do to us. They immediately presume that this parallel currency is something that the state is going to coin or mint on their own. Absolutely, positively not.
The states will be buying, they're basically using Federal Reserve notes to buy silver so they can pay bills in silver.
That's right. Yeah.
And what's their incentive to do that?
Huh?
What's their incentive to do that?
Well, hopefully enough of us as activists convince them that there's a need. That's the problem. You know, you've got to have enough people demanding it. But, you know, when you've seen the turnout of our economic summit, it looked pretty good down there. I'm telling you, there were a lot of people in that room, and they were mom-and-pop business owners that liked the idea. I mean, people were getting fed up with the value and the you know, the constant pumping of paper into a system that just further depreciates the value of every paper dollar in circulation.
Well, the question, I guess, that comes back to this, you know, the idea of return to gold and silver is certainly one of the options that's being proposed. But my question I have put to you right now is that there's nothing that prohibits people from taking Federal Reserve notes and converting that into silver coins that are measured by weight and then using them to go buy things. But nobody is.
Yeah, well, I wouldn't say nobody is. But it is a microcosm of society. And the encouraging thing, you know, I loved Tupper Saucy's book, The Miracle on Main Street. Did anybody else besides me read that a few years ago? You said that you wrote a book as a primer on this thing. Saucy put it right down to the, you know, how do you go into your hardware store? And a lot of folks that have started doing this recognize that, you know, if you go into a hardware store and say, I give you two choices, this or silver, and you lay that silver there, man, 9 times out of 10, they're going to grab that. So as long as you're smart enough to do the transaction without either ripping yourself off or ripping off the store owner, you know, you got to be honest in your weights and measures. So you need to understand those basic formula. But if you can do that, you can start getting more and more people interested in taking silver. As a salesman, one of the things that you learn about your second day in, you're going to hear no a few times before you hear yes. The worst thing anybody can ever say is no. One of our biggest problems is we don't even bother asking. Now, yeah, the store clerk in Walmart is going to probably stand behind management policy. They're not going to know how to deal with it. But if you're talking to the shop owner in a hardware store, he's going to know what he's talking about. You know, and he's going to look at that silver and say, yeah, I'd like to have some of that. It'd be nice if it was still in circulation. You can strike up pretty good conversations with people.
I guess the proof is in the pudding. There's nothing prohibiting people from doing exactly what you're talking about today. I mean, there's tons of people that are buying silver and gold right now, but they're not using it. They want to keep it. They don't want to give it to somebody else. I mean,
well,
they'd
probably
keep it
use it if they had the choice. And here's what I just recently did. I make maple syrup. I moved to Pennsylvania. Well, when God gives you lemons, make lemonade. In this case, one out of every three trees on the property here is maple. So I processed maple syrup last year, and my wife thought I was crazy. She was like, you know, you're not going to ask people for silver. They're not going to buy your maple syrup for silver. I didn't take a single Federal Reserve note. Every quart of maple syrup I sold was in silver. And I just, only because I asked, and I kept my foot down. I said, I don't want your paper. I want silver. You want the maple? It's going to cost you this. And they did it.
I'd like to interject here for a minute if I could. This is Dwayne, guys. Kurt, Aaron and I have been friends for a long time. In Pennsylvania here, even 3 years ago, before they raided the Liberty Dollar, I was having an amazing amount of success getting picked up in places like the camp, the convenience store. The clerks even...
Somebody's breathing too hard into a mic, so whoever's breathing either needs to mute themselves or stop breathing into your mic. Hey, Red?
Yeah.
Red?
Yeah?
Did you hear Aaron say that he's making maple syrup?
I heard it.
So, well, Dwayne, go ahead and say what you were saying. We were having a little trouble hearing because somebody was breathing into a mic. So.
That's quite all right. But that might have actually been Aaron. He goes outside once in a while. we were having a lot of success with the Liberty Dollar till they raided those guys. I was amazed at how many people were taking the silver pieces off me for my gasoline and for other products and stuff. And this was 3 years ago, before many people even knew what was going on. I'd be willing to say that if we found some common way to do this, like the Liberty Dollar almost had complete success with in this day and age, 3 years later, I think you'd have a lot more success.
Well, I think that there's no question that people have been loading up on silver and gold lately. In fact, there was a couple, 3 years ago, I went to a local dealer, and in time early in the morning, you see a woman that literally loaded her back of her car up, a woman that probably never walked into a coin store before, and she walked out with boxes and boxes and boxes of silver, probably $250,000 or more. But I don't see it in circulation.
Well, you know, if people start demanding it,
May I jump in for a second?
Yeah.
One of the elements of Dr. Vieira's legislation is based upon James Turk's electronic gold transfer. And one of the things that you can do with this system, the way that the legislation is written, is that you simply buy bullion and put it into a specie vault, and then it is accounted for through a separately, independently owned electronic transfer service. And what forces it into circulation, and this is a key part of this legislation, is that the state is collecting taxes, a portion of their taxes in it, and they are offering to pay contractors in it. That puts the retailers in a position of having to accept gold and silver, or particularly electronic gold transfer, digitized in whatever denomination you want. In other words, you can then trade gold at 10 cents for a dime, because you're no longer having to deal with a gold coin. You're dealing with a digitized fractional portion of whatever your ownership, your proprietary ownership of that precious metal is. That simplifies
the
process.
That was one of the things about the legislation that was so interesting to a couple of the South Carolina legislators, because they were looking around and they said, well, you know what? The Federal Reserve just moved out of Columbia. We got a big Federal Reserve building there with a beautiful vault in that's not being used for anything. We could just take that building and use it for our gold vault. And everybody was just cracking up. You know, wouldn't that just be poetic justice to have a former Federal Reserve vault be used to store the gold and silver for the state? But, they were interested in it. To them, it's unused office space.
But that changes the whole perspective, because, see, even on a local level, unless you're dealing with a fiat, which has its own problems even at a local level, if you're dealing with precious metals and forcing it into circulation, it changes the whole perspective. You can't do that on a local level because you don't have the economies of scale. You don't have a way to do the electronic transfer. You don't have the specie vaults in place. It takes the state to step into this in order to make it work effectively.
Right. It puts the power of the entire state behind the operation.
But it also provides a barrier to prevent the federal police state from coming in and stepping on the individual the way they did Von Nothaus at the Liberty Dollar.
Right. Right.
I'm kind of curious. Can a state issue a coin provided it's not denominated in dollars?
They need to stay out of that water. You know, there would be so many potential legal problems to it. There's no real reason for them to do it.
Right.
You know, they could contract and do all sorts of things, and one could even say, well, how? Why couldn't they do that when states do and have chartered banks from the beginning of time? What we're looking for here is constitutional enforcement, not trying to find creative ways to skirt the Constitution ourselves. So, you know, if you can get a state in its plenary authority to just say we're going to have a parallel currency, we're not going to print or coin anything, we're going to use what's already there, and, you know, if the federal government won't do its job and coin money, then fine, we'll use Australian money. We started this country with Spanish milled pieces of eight. We don't have to, you know, rely on American currency if Congress isn't going to do its constitutional obligation. That backs them into a real bad corner. You know, and that's the kind of thing that needs to come of this.
I think there'd be, I think for myself, I'm just kind of still trying to understand why it doesn't, but I don't want to belabor the point. Basically, I think if I understand what you're saying is you want the state to say, okay, we're going to accept it and we're going to use it. I think this begins to have a little bit more of a sweetener. Why will people do this and not hoard it, but in fact give it back to the state or, you know, use it in exchange, as if there's another parallel approach here, which is to say anything you do in gold and silver is inherently tax-free, at least from a state income tax standpoint. So
mm-hmm.
we don't, you know, if the value of ferns goes up and down, fine, but your silver is constant. Therefore, you know, anything that you pay us in taxes in silver is going to be a constant value kind of thing. Or anything that you do in exchange, if you, you know, use so many ounces of silver to go ahead and buy a car or something, or say you buy a car, then you later on you sell it, and it's all happening in silver, or you calculate in silver equivalents, it's essentially it's the capital gains taxes calculated in silver or gold equivalents or gold or silver that you have in deposit. That begins to add a sweetener why people say, oh, yeah, I'm going to use gold and silver because I'm going to save a lot in taxes.
Right. Well, here's the other sweetener. If the state's spending that into circulation, which is what the ultimate goal of this is, that's putting wealth right into the real wealth into the hands of the people. So, you know, this whole federal system can collapse. Fine. Let it. All that gold and silver, the real wealth, will have come toward the state capital of any state that's bold enough to do this. So while, you know, 90% of other states are running around filing bankruptcy and trying to figure out how to live, you know, the states that do this are going to be protecting both themselves and their people from the financial ruin that's going to happen all around them. That should be incentive enough. And, that, you know, that's the whole goal of it. You immediately start the flow of real wealth toward any state that does this. And it flows in, but it doesn't flow out because no other states are doing it. So the money's coming toward the state that does it. And it's staying in that state. And even what Mike Pitts was suggesting, that the state could buy gold and silver, you know, with the monies that come in, directly from another state. If Nevada has mines operating and they have mints and stuff coining, you know, silver rounds, and they just need to put silver in the state treasury, then they could just be buying the silver, you know, from a sister state. So it becomes a matter of state friendliness one to another. The producer can sell to the consumer. So you've got all those market factors going on there that makes for good state relations between one another. Individuals don't have that kind of clout, but boy, if a state does it, you got all kind of interesting stuff happening.
How does the I think one of the objectives of any monetary system reform should be to pay down the federal and the states, hopefully, in personal debt. How would you, in that system, accomplish that? Would you?
Well, there's a lot of Bible believers on this phone call, right?
Yes, sir.
Now think about that one for a minute. Aren't we supposed to forgive our debts after every 7 years? I mean, that's where the federal law comes from, that a person, even an individual, if the creditor doesn't try to collect it within 7 years, it's wiped off their history.
The year of Jubilee.
we need to start applying that on a state level, don't we? And on a federal level. I mean, we've got debts accumulating in this country going clear back to the War of Northern Aggression. Time to wipe some of that stuff off the books, man. The father's not supposed to be held accountable for the sins of the son, and the son's not supposed to be held accountable for the sins of the father. Why should me and you be in debt when we didn't authorize this stuff 75 years before we were even born, for Pete's sake?
So your proposal would rest upon basically some law dictating that people have investments would have to forego their income or forego their principal?
Well, let's just call it what it is. Unjust gain, usury, which is what these banks are sucking from us at an alarming rate, has no place in a so-called Christian nation. These guys need to just put their big boy pants on and deal with it. These types of debts and obligations are invalid by any standard you want to measure them with.
Aaron, I have a loaded question for you. How do you justify that with a statutory law?
Well, the statutes are the ones that say that the debts are forgiven in 7 years. So by common law, by statute law, by God's law, all three seem to agree in this case.
Mm-hmm.
They just try not to apply them, and the banks want us to think that don't apply to them. They're too big to fail, remember? We have to bail them out.
That would also discourage these astronomical loan amounts as well, because nobody would want to loan too much out knowing you might not get it back in 7 years.
Yeah, well, that's the problem with all of our states. It's called greed. That is another biblical concept for everybody here.
Mm-hmm.
You know, these people want to borrow their way to prosperity. You and I can't do that, neither can a government. And if these things are sins on a personal level, unjust weights and measures, putting your thumb on the scale, you know, cheating people out of things or lending to your brother at interest, at usury. If they're a sin at a personal level, how much greater a sin are they at a national level?
Red?
Here.
I'm waiting for you to jump into this conversation.
I think it's so, there's so much value in discussions such as this, because this monetary thing is so complex. It has been created as complex to try to make it so that that we, the working people, we just don't want to get into the all the details, and we want some experts to take care of this. And we really, we, the working people, we better get a handle on some of this money thing and how it all works. And I. As I'm listening here, I think that we have to, as Christian people, we have to start out with the scriptural explanation, I guess you could say, of where we're at and how we got here. And so if we go to the temptation, Satan's temptation of the Lord Jesus Christ, in the book of Luke there, it's fascinating reading, of course. Lucifer takes Christ up on a high mountain and shows him the wealth, the power, and the kingdoms of the earth.
That he controls.
And he told Christ, he said, if you will bow down and serve me, I will give this all to you. And he goes on Luke 4:6. He says, "For these were presented to me." He was given the wealth, the power, and the kingdoms of the earth, and that's why the scripture says that Satan is the god of this world. And there has to be a very clear understanding of all of this to be able to digest all of this nonsense and this confusion that we have with monetary systems. All we have to do is recognize the source and understand why we have all this confusion. And I don't think we should be trying to take over that system or anything else. I think we should be coming up with some better ideas. North Dakota had their North Dakota State Bank until recently. They were independent, and what a tremendous asset the North Dakota Bank, State of North Dakota Bank, was to that state. And so I think that we need some people out here that will take a good look at North Dakota State Bank and how they operated, how they functioned.
I've talked about that one with Dr. Vieira, too, and there's a couple of snafus that can come into it. First of all, if it becomes a state bank and it simply participates in the Federal Reserve System, it's no better than any other, Chase Manhattan. But the concept is a solid one, and especially if a state would go to a gold and silver system or even partially and then use that state bank as its distribution mechanism, it could be worked in that way.
May I jump in here for a second?
Yeah, go ahead.
May I jump in? First of all, those snafus have happened in North Dakota. The governor up there, through some nepotism, et cetera, has appointed somebody who has literally signed away the regulation of that bank to the feds.
Mm-hmm.
Second of all, to quote Dr. Edwin Vieira, if you have a state bank that is not based on sound money, that is based upon a fiat, like Kate says, it's a past governor who did this. It's not the current governor. The guy is now a senator. It was Hoven that did this. He signed away the regulation of that bank so that they basically are now tied to the Fed. And to quote Dr. Vieira, if you do not have sound money in that bank, no matter if it's a state bank, is tied to the Federal Reserve note. If the Federal Reserve note goes down, the Federal Reserve goes down, so goes that state bank.
Absolutely. Well, and I'll tell you, if you folks want to check something out, I did a presentation as part of our Sound Money Summit in South Carolina. We shot the video. It was for a 9/12 group the week of that. I was there, and I just said, farm me out, put me where you want me. And I did this biblical presentation on money. And it's, of course, the only one of the group that really took that angle. But we look at Deuteronomy, and we compare it with Article 1, Section 8. We look at, the scriptures that say the gold is mine and the silver is mine, saith the Lord of hosts. And we compare that with what they did in the Constitutional Convention and the words that they used, and they called paper money a pernicious expedient. I mean, there's religious overtones all over the word pernicious when they were talking about paper money. And there's only one place to see that, and it's actually kind of hidden. I've put it there really for people that I want to see it. But if you go to that nvcca.net website and you put /econ, econ, .html after it, it'll bring you up to that hidden economics page. And the Vieira video is there and some other things that were part of that, Larry Park's videos and other things. But there's one there that's, Aaron Bollinger speaking about the biblical connection with sound money. And it was about a half hour, 45-minute presentation. But several people have seen that, preachers have seen that, and they've said, I need to teach this one to my congregation. because it shows how the Father will bless us for using his money and how that was woven into our constitutional structure by some pretty smart folks, including Roger Sherman, for whom we named Sherman Institute. I got some flack from a couple people in the South. They seemed Sherman, and they thought we named the campus here for William Tecumseh Sherman. I'm like, no, this was not a W.T. Sherman. This is a Roger Sherman Institute, the only man that signed all four of our principal founding documents and the author of Article 1, Section 10. So I've had to explain that to a few people. But anyway, that video has the biblical research is there that we can use to carry this to people. And I'd like nothing better than preachers to watch this. It really helps them to digest what we're talking about. And it makes it real to them in a contemporary sense. You know, we can think about a lot of the stuff that's in the Bible, and first thing out of people's mind, you know, or mouth is, well, you know, we're no longer under the law and all that stuff doesn't apply. The Father owns the gold and silver. That's his. He gave it to us to use as money. You know, and we gave the Congress the power to fix the standard of weights and measures in the same sentence as them having the power to coin money. And that was done so that our weights and our measures would be uniform and just. So, you know, that's all right there, as plain as daylight for anybody that cares enough to, you know, dig those particular clauses and phrases and assemble them in accordance with Scripture, because it's right there. Plain sight, hidden in plain sight.
Well, Kirk, I would like for you to consider how we can put the Sherman Institute to good use within our plan of action. And I want you guys to be able to communicate on an ongoing basis. And I'm really, really pleased that I've got both of you on here at the same time. We've got about a half an hour left for this show. We started 15 minutes late. We're going to be able to run over 15 minutes past the normal time. So we've got about a half an hour left, and I'm not sure exactly where
the best.
I'm not real
sure my battery's going to last that long, but if I drop off, I love you all and thank you for having me. And if in the meanwhile I die here on this phone I'm using, my apologies. But anybody is welcome to call on me or use me in any way possible for the greater good here. I live for this stuff. So how much longer I'll live, that's up to the Father. But as long as I have a breath in me, I want to try to teach the new generation how to carry on where we leave off.
Well, Aaron, before I turn Kirk loose on you, I want to come back to this issue of the maple syrup. Now, what you don't know, Aaron, I don't think I've shared with you, is that Red Beckman, his son, has cancer. And one of the things that they've been working with as an alternative treatment, Red, is it okay if I go here?
Go ahead.
An alternative treatment is the baking soda and maple syrup remedy, which, Red, I'll let you talk about it for a second. And I'm just wondering, Aaron, how Red can send you some silver and get some maple syrup to cook up for what they're doing up there. So,
I've heard of that remedy. I've heard it from several sources.
Anyone can find it on the internet. Google, go to Google and start waiting around in that mess, and sooner or later you'll find it, because around our house, where we don't have a lot of computer whizzes, we found it without too much trouble. But there's a medical doctor in Italy that has used this baking soda in a cure for cancer, and he's been quite successful, apparently. And he's catching a lot of flack, so that tells us he's probably on target.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot of people in this country who are really working on alternatives. And my son, he didn't go to the doctors. He thought he had a back that needed adjusting, so he went to a chiropractor a few times, and finally the chiropractor told him, "Hey, you got something more problem, and you better go and have it checked out." And by then he was a stage four, and all the tests showed that he was full of cancer. His lungs, his liver, his esophagus, and his and even in his head, he had five tumors inside of his head. So it was caught pretty early. But melanomas are notoriously bad, and all. And so when the doctors told him that it was terminal. And one of my daughters was there and got in on a lot of it. And so we have the witnesses that the doctors say that he's terminal. In other words, they can't do anything for him. So we just, around our home, we couldn't survive without challenges. Challenges keep us going. And We just decided we had to take an alternative route. I have a resonant light Rife machine. He's on that. We've got this maple syrup and the baking soda. He's got this all set up to where he needs. Takes these medications at just certain times during the day, and of course, one of the things that really got my attention, they wanted to do radiation on his head. They said we've got to slow those growths. We got to slow them down. Well, are you going to wipe them out, or are they going to disappear, or what? No, we'll just slow them down. Instead of you dying tomorrow, you'll die day after tomorrow. And they want $50,000 or $60,000 for the treatment. So it wasn't too hard to make up our mind not to go that route. Marijuana, they have found how to make this oil from the marijuana, and it's very potent stuff. And of course, with my rheumatism and such, why I've got a marijuana card in Oregon and one in Washington, both. And my daughter, too, because she has a daughter I have a granddaughter that's in very poor shape. That's another story. But I thought about this marijuana a great deal. I had heard the author of the book, The Emperor Hath No Clothes, I had heard him on a radio interview many years ago down in California. I heard the interview, and I kept in mind what he had said. A lot of what he said made so much sense. And then one day it dawned on me that after learning more about it, the marijuana plant is one of the most useful plants that our Creator put on this planet. It is a plant with such a potential. Make the best paper, and much better paper than wood, and you can grow more paper on an acre of marijuana than you'll ever grow with an acre of trees. And so it dawned on me, and I may be wrong, and that's why I want to bounce it off of you experts out there tonight. I believe that Lucifer, knowing that that is a plant that man was to be able to use. It was the best cash crop of American agriculture until about 1900. There was a great market for it then. There's still a great market for it in Europe and different places. And so I got to thinking, what kind of people do we have in the Congress back in Washington and all the bureaucracy? What kind of people are these people that wrote these laws about people using marijuana? These people haven't written a good law in my memory. I mean, they just don't. I mean, they have to. They have to do it wrong. Otherwise, they don't do it. And so these people are just doing Lucifer's errands. They just pass a law that says that we can't use the plant that God gave us that has so many uses. There's some scientists say there's over 200 elements in there, identifiable elements, and others say it could be as many as 400.
Well, I think Red, the answer to your question is hidden in plain sight. Think about it from the concept of the English language. Pro is the opposite of con, right?
Yeah.
What's the opposite of progress? Congress. It's simple. It's hidden in plain sight.
That was pretty good. I'll have to give you credit for coming up with a pretty good one. It's like somebody's got a campaign tax thing, 999, and somebody told me this. All you got to do is turn it over, and it's 666.
Yeah. Hey, you know, sometimes, well, I've been practicing to teach speech and English classes, so I've been playing or being a little wordsmith lately. But as far as my ability to help with maple syrup, the syrup season starts about late January, early February. Whenever you get that first real thaw out and the sap starts running, I'll be producing. And last year...
We didn't have any trouble finding it.
Yeah. Well, it'll be out there again this year. And I started slow last year till I learned how to do it. That was my first experience with it. But we got a great big 125-gallon boiling tank now and 155-gallon buckets to hang on the trees. I got enough trees here I could probably do it by running hoses and making a pretty good commercial operation out of it, but I have sheep running around, and they'd probably just mess up my piping anyway, so I'll just stick with the buckets.
Yeah.
I think I made about 40 gallon of syrup, and it's only been the last week, or, well, maybe two and a half weeks now, that I ran out, and I sold a good bit. So that's all I've used. I haven't had to buy any sugar. I never really do like to use processed sugar. I always try to find the Demerara natural cane that still has the molasses in it if I have to buy sugar. But, yeah, I'll make more this year than I did last. I've got more ability to process it now.
Yeah, there's one more thing that... I think that everybody thinking as we do and being such a small minority, I think we need to keep it on file in the back of our minds that the federal government has become the federal god. Violation, the government is in violation of the First Commandment.
Yep.
I went to the courthouse, Yellowstone County Courthouse, and living there, and I read the entire decision where the U.S. Supreme Court took the Bible out of the public school classroom, 1963. I read that entire decision. There's a lot of verbiage there, but the way I read it, the U.S. Supreme Court said, thou shalt not have any other god before the federal god.
That sums it up pretty nicely.
I think that we have to think about how we are going to fit in if the federal government is dissolved overnight, just like it was in the USSR in December of 91. It was the same gang of thieves that controlled the Kremlin then, and they also control Washington, D.C. They got away with that collapse of the USSR back there in 91, and I believe that the possibility of us having the same thing happen right here is highly probable. And I think we need to keep that in the back of our minds and recognize that we may, I told a lady here a while back, she wondered about doing things and getting involved, and I said, God only uses people who make themselves available. This is what we need today, is people who have made themselves available. And I think they're coming out of the woodwork right now.
Here's an interesting epiphany I had a couple of weeks ago, and I think it applies to what you've just touched on there with that particular court case. You know, wasn't that long ago historically that the notion of any common man having a Bible in their hand was against the law. The Index Librorum Prohibitorum, the Index of Prohibited Books, the Bible was top on the list. Now, isn't it that spirit of that mother of harlot church that caused that to take place, evidenced in that same spirit of Antichrist that would say we can't have a Bible in schools now, and by the same token, the same exact line of thinking applies to the judge who says, the Constitution is not at issue in my courtroom. You know, we can't have the Constitution, we can't have the Bible. Doesn't it seem like that same spirit of Antichrist is working within those people? And how we now have a 5-4 Catholic majority on the Supreme Court, and all of our key committees are controlled by members of the papacy, and we have immigration explosion of people coming in from Latin American / translate that ever fresh translation being Catholics allowed to come in here scot-free because that's what the Vatican wants. As long as we have those people in control, we're going to get exactly the government they want us to have. It just all fits too neatly to be coincidence. I don't believe in coincidence where government's concerned.
Well, we've got about 16 minutes left, and I'd like for Kurt to be able to jump in here a little bit. Kurt?
Well, I think rather than talk any further about the money, if that's okay, I'd like to talk a little bit about some of the ideas about how we take our country back. Is that okay?
Yeah.
Absolutely, and I definitely want you to spend a couple of minutes talking about next week's show that you've helped put together.
Sure, I'd be happy to do that. I think that the thing that all of us probably realize is that this is a long-term battle. This isn't. I think a lot of people have the opinion that we can defeat a piece of legislation, or we can hold back the, you know, the government from taking down these four dams, and that's a solved problem. It's not. This is an ongoing battle. It's never going to end. The people that are, in my opinion, they're engaged on the opposite side of this, the Wizards of Oz behind the the Curtin are the international bankers and what gives them the power is the monetary system and the control of that and the usury and all the things that go along with that and fractional reserve banking and debt monetization, et cetera. So I think what we have to begin to realize is that the problems are so deep and so wide that there is, you know, literally hundreds of issues that face us every day, all of them extremely important at this point, you know, whether it's global warming fraud or it's the taking of the dams or it's the Obamacare or whatever, you know, there's all these fronts going on. I think it's very important that we differentiate those things where if we focus on them, we can actually begin to win. I think what we have is a situation where most of the people, most of the groups are reacting to today's news and, oh, my God, Senate Bill X and, you know, House Bill Y. Oh, God, start faxing your senators and congressmen. I think we have to abandon that notion. Those people are not going to be influenced by that. It's not working. I don't think that waving the flags, going out to the corner and holding up signs works. I think we have to take a realistic assessment of really what it's going to take. And I believe that part of that is we have to build a structure that simultaneously we have to go after their base of their power. And these are things that were lost in the financial legislation of our history. There are certainly things that were lost in the Civil War, and there are certainly things that were lost in 1913. And we've all been, we're not educated or trained in those things, and so most people don't even realize what I'm talking about. But really, we have to revive those issues because those are core issues, and I think we have to go off on the offense. And then secondarily, there's a few things that I think we have to focus on the defense where they have the initiative, such as taking over our private property, water rights, closing down dams, et cetera. We're running a defensive war, but here again, we tend to try and do things at the last minute, and it just doesn't work. So I think that the infrastructure looks something like this. And this is some of the concepts I laid out in How to Take Our Country Back, Part 1. At the foundation of this, we have to have the truth. People who truly do understand the world. And I think I can count on one hand the number of people that I talk to that really do get it. But people who have at least a piece of the truth or bigger parts of it, they have to really understand the truth to the point of the history behind it, what's how it's come together, what the implications are, how to do something about it. Those who understand the truth then have an obligation, in my opinion, to do what I call the toolkit, and that is to assemble the best of the best, whether it's YouTube videos, it's books, it's white papers, it's handouts, websites, whatever. And I think that we should show no pride of authorship here. You know, if I felt that G. Edward Griffin has a particularly unique part of this story, I would link to that. He should link to mine. I think what we should do is accumulate a small handful of the best materials on all the issues that we care about. And then the next layer in this whole thing is that we have to build a layer of organization. An enduring organization, and enduring means a lot of things. It's sustainable. It means it has to be economically sustainable. It has to be personality sustainable. It has to be something where there's a layer of communication, coordination, and cooperation that, for the most part, I think does not exist. I think there's a lot of separate organizations, each of whom, if you peel away the names where they're called 912 or Tea Party or Campaign for Liberty or, you know, this group, that group, the bottom line is that they share common values. So we have to find the magic formula whereby they can maintain their autonomy and continue to make their own decisions and they can raise their own money and nobody's telling them no. But on the other hand, they have to voluntarily participate in a broader level of what I call communication, coordination, cooperation, kind of a roundtable approach. Nobody's dictating, but through cooperative approach, people begin to work together in a synergistic fashion. And so you have to put in a layer of communication to make that happen, and you have to put in the coordination, and you have to put in the cooperation. So there's something that has to happen there. And part of that is that the truth and the toolkit that have been assembled, usually the people that come up with that information cannot simultaneously do all the research, do all the toolkit, and expect to also be the distributors or the marketing people. They really need to have another layer of people who understand that this is good stuff, and they help to get it out to a large mass of people in a very effective way. And so I think that that part of that communication is people who do understand things like YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, email, use the tools that are available to us to get things going viral, the truth to go viral. And then once we have that communication and coordination, we need a level of, in my opinion, a strategy. I mean, so we kind of understand the world. We have the materials to educate people. We have the cooperative, you know, the organizational synergy together. So now where are we going? So there has to be a strategy behind that. And it has to be well thought out. It has to be historically based. It has to be based upon a real understanding of things. And, you know, that was the purpose of How to Take Our Country Back, Part 1. And now that we know that we're driving from San Francisco to Boston, like, you know, I understand Boston's a target now, then how the heck do I get there? You know, how do I drive and what's the route? That's where tactics comes into play. And I think that a lot of the conservatives or people who are trying to defend the Constitution generally are not very comfortable with being confrontational. They have to get over that. There's a great book about that. They have to be able to deal with the Delphi technique. In other words, they have to get down to a level, you know, understand Saul Alinsky, figure out what parts of they can use without giving up their moral values. In other words, there's a set of techniques. It's almost like you want to have a training school for people to kind of get this picture. So you know where you're headed, you know how you're going to get there, and you've got the infrastructure to work together. Now you go pick your targets and you be selective, because we've got to have some wins here, and we've got to figure out the formula, and we've got to communicate that to a lot of other people. And in my opinion, the one of those is going to be the campaign to save the four dams in Siskiyou County, because I think that this is a pivotal battle, in my opinion, or can be made to be so. I think government perceives it as a pivotal one, and I think we do too. So, but in any case, I think that those are the kinds of things that I think that are lacking. I think a lot of people know about the problems. There's a lot of talk about this. There's a lot of action, but not a whole heck of a lot of, you know, results. You know, I'm an engineer. When I took engineering, the fact is that work equals force times distance. You know, force alone doesn't do it. You got to make distance to actually accomplish something. So I would be one that would advocate people would need to take time to think this thing through. I would suggest to come watch my stuff and do that, but everybody should start to think a little long term, because this is not going to be resolved overnight, and they have to reconcile themselves to that fact.
I hear you loud and clear. That's something I've preached to a lot of the folks that I've talked to, and it's unfortunate, but we live in this, you know, if the web page doesn't load within 5 seconds, I'm clicking close and going somewhere else mentality. That's a horrible reality in America today. This instant gratification is so on top of people, but you know, these battles started before any of us were born. You know, the first time they introduced the Federal Reserve Act, they didn't get it passed. It took them years. And it's taken us years to get in this current situation. And I try to encourage everybody I talk to that, you know, watches Aaron Russo's movie and suddenly they want to become an activist. You're not going to get out there and fight any of these battles. We've talked about this with the money issue. You know, the very first thing you got to do is get the bill introduced. And we know it's not going to pass the first year. We'll be lucky if it passes 10 years from now. But if we get at least a bill number, we got something to point people to, generate discussions, start moving toward some goal, which might not be, you know, this session or next session. But, you know, okay, maybe this time it does make it out of committee, but it dies on the floor of the Senate. Next time it makes it through the Senate to the House, dies in a committee in the House. Next time makes it through that committee. And finally, we've got all this public support, and it does pass. Those are the kind of ways that I think, and I'm glad to hear you talk like that, because, you know, it's just the reality of it. I've been around this thing for 30 years, and sometimes I wonder if we've made any progress at all, but when I sit back and I think about it, we really have. Can't always measure it, but it's there. You can feel it.
Well, I think the fact that there are a few of us who do get it and have been thinking this over and thinking about a strategy is really good. I think programs like this where you engage in the dialogue and begin to turn, you know, take each of these ideas and kind of turn it over and analyze it, look at it and in a constructive fashion, I think is a good exercise. I do think that for myself, the thing that I don't still understand is exactly the state program in pretty simple terms to understand core elements that are important. What is the, you know, motivations of everybody in the system to make this, you know, money flow, and exactly what the benefits are to people that do that. So there are still, to me, some things to understand there. But I'm glad that we're beginning to I respect the work that has been done. I do believe that state part of the solution, and I like the fact that we're beginning to, you know, broaden out the dialogue on this. I think that's all very good.
Well, I'm here for anybody that needs me. I've been at it for 30 years and I ain't quitting anytime soon unless the Father takes me out of the battle. And if he does, then it's all yours. He can call me tomorrow. I'd be okay with that, you know.
Kurt, we've only got about 3 minutes left. I want to make sure you talk a little bit about next week's show.
Oh, well, we're going to have basically the Siskiyou story is being presented in all the different facets that bear on this, so we're going to have a show next week to go into that. We're going to have the sheriff, let me just double check here my calendar, you have to bear with me. We're going to have Sheriff Glenn Palmer from Grant County, Oregon, who Sheriff Mack considers to be the most constitutional sheriff in the nation. He was one of the people that attended the 8-sheriff panel that installed for the Constitution. And then in addition, we're going to have Sheriff Mack on the show. So I think we're going to have a very interesting conversation, which is going to be taking the whole program that Sheriff Mack has been talking about for so many years, its application in a county where we have the sheriffs and actually an area where we have the sheriffs behind us, we have the commissioners behind us, we have all the law and the science and, you know, all the rationale on the side of the state that we're in here, and try and focus attention on that and certainly bring in the whole thinking of that and tie kind of the goal perspective of, hey, sheriffs can be part of the solution to showing how it exactly works in a specific situation underneath the overall of umbrella of defending America. Because rural America is probably a smaller part of our population, but it's 95% of the land, and we've forgotten that's where our water comes from, our food comes, energy comes from. I mean, we wouldn't be a sovereign or a prosperous nation if it weren't for those people out there and the resources, the land, and that's under attack, and I had no idea.
Hello?
Did we lose somebody?
I think so.
I think we lost our speaker. I had heard it sound like he was cutting in and out.
Terry, we just won a sheriff's election here in my county. Aaron, I don't know if you're familiar, but we got a great constitutional sheriff just won this election this week. Would you like to have him on board next week?
Oh, I'd like to talk to him privately.
Terry, would you like to have him on your show?
Kirk is live again. Ask him that question again, Dwayne.
Oh, okay.
Sorry about that. My battery died first.
I'm sorry, Kirk. We're running out of time here just real quickly. In our county here in Pennsylvania, we just had a constitutional sheriff win an election. It blew our minds that he won. Would you like to have him on board with you?
Absolutely.
I'll see if I can line that up for you. He's probably very busy just having taken over the office here, but I'll see if I can't get him on.
Dwayne, have less than 1 minute. I'd like to thank all of you guys for joining us tonight, but we did not get to start the show off with prayer. I'd like to end it with it. Dwayne, would you do that for me?
I'd be honored and delighted to do that for my Savior, for you guys. You bet. Heavenly Father, thank you so much. All of us here, Terry, Red, Kirk, and my buddy Aaron, all you guys, Father, bring us into a wholeness and a oneness of one accord in your scripture, in your word, in your spirit. Father, that we might go out into the world now having made some progress and understanding how your world works, that we might take it to the world and spread this gospel unto every creature, just as you've said that we should do. Father, we thank you for this opportunity. We thank you for all the wonderful things and the progress that we are making. And we thank you, Father, for the wonderful hearts that are here, how they're making so many inroads to one another and fitting all the right puzzle pieces together. And we ask, Father, that you continue to make it work with us. In the name of your Son, Yeshua HaMashiach, we ask these things in your power and your glory. Amen.
Boy, I appreciate everybody's patience for getting this show started tonight. And it's been a great show. Looking forward to next week. Thank you very much.
Good night.
My pleasure.
Good night.
Good having me.
Watching a jackass chase a dumb pack of dough. What a show. Stepping on any shoulder that I can find. Have anyone in there? Have I changed their mind? It's time to go to the real world outside with those pirate ships. Fucking sailors with dirty lips. They rule the night. They rule the night. Don't be afraid of the wicked men. There's more of us than there are of them. Come join the fight. Follow me.